I am Plata on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Nick Bantock joins me now. The beloved artist and author has just published a new book, Dubious Documents, A Puzzle, is a fascinating visual epistolary puzzle. Between its covers there are 16 envelopes, each containing created ephemera that provide cryptic anagrams, number puzzles, pictograms, and wordplay. I'll ask Mr. Bantock about this new release, how he works, and the reception he's received over a distinguished career that includes the worldwide sensation Griffin and Sabine. This new book is published by Chronicle Books. He lives in Victoria, British Columbia, where he joined me from a couple of weeks ago. Please welcome to the Plata Online program, Nick Bantock. Mr. Bantock, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
I'm happy to be here.
By the way, do you consider yourself an author?
Oh, God, that's a good question to start off with. I'm a Mongol. I'm half artist, half author. I started out being an artist ever since the age of 15, but didn't start writing until I was 40. So in some ways, I kind of lean more in the visual direction.
Yeah, and as I was telling you before we started, just how beautiful Dubious Documents is. One can spend an hour or two just looking at everything before they even get to, say, solving the puzzle. I was telling you, I've started trying to figure out the puzzle, but I'm not a terribly bright person, so I'm not. It's going to be a while before I get there, but I'm so enjoying just looking at everything.
Well, the puzzle aspect is to some extent you can take it or leave it. If you know those people who don't really want to sort of lose themselves for days, weeks, hours,
yeah,
in that sort of brain-bending world, they don't have to. For those of us who are addicted to that kind of thing, once you're in, you can't get out until you've got to the end of the maze.
I've got people who want to borrow the book already, and they're probably going to have to buy them a copy instead.
Jumps to get out there.
Yeah, because they do want to solve this thing. Let's talk about the book's design, because, I mean, that's part and parcel. I mean, it's obviously it's the work that you've done in creating it, but, I mean, for whatever you've been working on, say, in your workspace, and then the book that I'm holding here now in Vancouver, there's obviously the work of the publisher. How different is this book that I'm holding, Dubious Documents, from say, what you've imagined?
I shepherd things through, I have to, as far as I possibly can. And so, in that sense, my control is anal. But it just has to be. I mean, after 27 years and 30-odd books, I know that if you let things go, and it would be nice to just trust others to be in your mind and know what you want, it never works that way. So you just have to keep going and going and going to the very end until you get what you want.
And I hate to ask this question, but I'm sure you're asked this a lot as you're talking about this book. How long does a project like this take?
Well, from the moment I went to Chronicle Books with the idea, the gap between there and when they actually committed to it was about 18 months. And it was that long because it's hard for, even though I'd worked with them for many, many years, it's hard to get your head around this kind of concept, mostly because it actually works backwards. Most publishers, they think in terms of text, idea, story, and then image added to that. But to build a book like this, you have to start with the images and then write everything else into it. So it's hard for them to fully comprehend what's happened. So it's in fact an act of trust on their part, and that's why it took so long. So from start to finish, from the conception of the idea to the book being out, it's been 4 years.
And so what part of that process do you least enjoy?
I least enjoy the very last bit, where you're angsting about will production pick up on everything, will the transmissions between their end and the printers go well. Back in the old days, we used to get three sets of proofs, which allowed us to pick up on a lot of errors. But now, with everything sort of moving so electronically quickly, and at the same time, publishers trying to sort of cut financial corners, it means that there's less potential for catching any small things that might go wrong.
But I ask that question because when I'm looking at something that you've created, one of these pages in one of the envelopes, even the envelopes themselves, it's easy to get lost in them. And I'm wondering for you as its creator.
I love it. You must enjoy it,
don't you?
I love the process. I mean, you know, particularly if when you grow up as an artist, you learn a kind of trust in that process. And the more the years go past, the more your skill levels develop, the more willing you are to give myself over to whatever comes out. So, in other words, I'm not using quite the same part of my brain as I was when I first started. Initially, you're using your powers of logic, and more and more as time goes by, you allow the other side of your brain, that which works on an intuitive basis, attached to your pre-built technical skill level.
And it must just be delightful to create the ephemera that you have. I mean, it must be even.
Yeah, well, I've been collecting stuff for years, and when you just start to tamper with it, and, I mean, they're called dubious documents for a reason. They actually, in sense of history, they make no sense. Whatsoever. I mean, they become the sense within nonsense. So that part of it, you're not tied to any historical necessity, and so you can just be really naughty with what you do.
Yeah. And the other thing I realize is that this would not be a good ebook because there's really nothing like holding a book in your hand, is there?
Yeah, it did. I mean, we have done e-books in the past, and I've done apps, but for me, the tactile nature of holding on to something, in the same way that I love having a pencil or paintbrush in my hand, or a pen, like an old fountain pen, I love the feel of the paper under my hand, all of those things have to transmit through to the book itself, so that it actually... It's sort of tangibly sexy.
Yeah. And you mentioned a fountain pen. I'm talking to you. I've got mine in my hand here.
Good man.
and people think, I'm 36, and so people think it's odd that I'm using a fountain pen. But, man, it's just, there's nothing better to write with, is there?
Absolutely. It slows you down. It makes sure that you actually think and say exactly what it is you want to say. Mm. I mean, we're living in a sort of an age of short texts, often where punctuation isn't used, where confusion is rife, because what the person thinks they're saying isn't necessarily what the person receiving understands. So when you write with a pen on paper, you tend to slow, consider your words, and just express yourself so much more completely.
And there's something about the actual device itself. I mean,
yeah.
You do have to take care of it because it did cost a lot more than, say, a ballpoint would.
Yeah.
And then you have to fill it yourself, which is, some people might not like that process. But, I mean, I find it incredible. My desk is full of ink blots and the sort of thing.
I just came back from Paris. I was there for a couple of weeks, and while I was away, I bought four old fountain pens in various places throughout my trip. And the satisfaction of hunting things out and then sort of feeling them and seeing what marks they make, it's just delightful.
Yeah, and it does. You do take the time, don't you, to just stay with it and look at it and contemplate. The part it plays in your life, not to mention if you let your mind wander and wonder, who's had it before, right?
Yeah, and it's a kind of sanity balance. When you're moving so quickly and everyone seems to be trying to multitask, which is in fact an impossibility, there's no such thing as multitasking. Yeah. Just alternating what you do.
This book, Dubious Documents, I mean, it gives us a different way to look at things, and that's a great gift of the book and I guess all your previous work. That's always a goal for you when you work, right?
It is. And particularly with Dubious Documents, where I very much would like it for people to chat with their friends. You know, you can't solve a clue, then ask your friend, or maybe even, you know, two or three people or a family sit down together and work your way through something. It's a great way to teach kids how to actually think. Lateral thinking, critical thinking, all of those things which come out when something isn't tied up with a neat bow and you've actually got to work a little bit at it to get your reward. And if you're doing it with your kids or your loved one, it's there's something bonding about.
Yeah, it'll surprise a lot of people that something can be so arresting, yet have no electronic stimulation whatsoever.
Yeah. When it certainly doesn't have a knee-jerk quality. It's much more of a gentle stroking than it is jarring.
Were there books like the ones that you've done over the years that say you grew up with that you liked or perhaps wanted to emulate later on?
Well, when it came to because the first one I did was in Goodhart envelopes with actual letters in that, to my knowledge, hadn't been done before. There had been the same year that my Griffin's Bean came out, which was in 1991. There was also a little book called Pat the Postman, but which used a similar sort of principle, but it was for children. Mm-hmm. And whereas Griffin's Bean was much more complex on many, many levels, and was designed as a form of intentional voyeurism.
Yeah.
You know, the voyeurism in the sense of reading someone else's mail with mm-hmm. permission, particularly when it's in the form of a love story in a thriller, is a way of being pulled into it, you know, sort of deeper and deeper. Whilst I'm with Griffin's Bean, I must remember to say this, the play of Griffin's Bean is going to be at the Belfry Theatre in Victoria this December.
Yeah, and so that must be, I mean, you mentioned it came out in 91, having this sort of new life on stage.
Yeah.
That must be equally as rewarding, or it's a different sort of rewarding, I guess, for you, isn't it?
Yeah, it's going to be in a sort of a form that is, I might say, not overly theatrical, intentional, like in the same way that someone, an actor might stand up and do a monologue. This will, to all intents and purposes, be a duologue, which allows you to focus much more on the intensity of the words, although the play will have projected images behind it. So it will have a sort of visual element as well.
I'm sure a lot of people talk to you about Griffin and Sabine, and have over the years. I mean, it's affected a lot of people, hasn't it?
Almost scarily so, in the sense that, you know, in a weird way. I mean, so when people sort of write or stop you and say, I called my son Griffin or my daughter Sabine, you kind of have to think, am I somehow paternally responsible? It is a very, very weird thing, and particularly because recently I found out that in 92 the name Griffin jumped on the names list massively from down in the hundreds to into the top few.
Right.
So you know, knowing that you've had this an effect like that, but, you know, I tend to, I mean, I'm fairly recluse on one level. So I tend to shy away from, you know, thinking that way. But when it bumps into you, it's kind of weird.
The other thing about you, Nick, is that you're an artist and I'll use the word, an author, who is well-liked and in a lot of instances beloved. Did you feel that at all?
Initially, I didn't want to sort of take it on board, probably because of a sort of that sense that you don't want to become bloated by your own publicity or somebody else's praise. But I think over the years it's seeped in to the extent where I feel validated that this is what my life has been. I mean, I've been very lucky. I've got to do exactly what I wanted to do. But the fact that I managed to sort of have an outlet for communication and that it's been meaningful to other people, it gives you a great sense of one's right to actually be here. I mean, although, having said that, it never ends. You can't sit back on your laurels. I mean, I'm working on the next things, and after that, I'll be working on the next thing. So when people say to me, you know, sort of, when do you retire? I always want to laugh, because you don't get to retire. It's just, you know, you keep going till you pop your clogs.
Yeah, it must be. It's one thing to say get adulation, but it can also be a challenge for some people. But for you, and this is what's to admire the most about you, is that how it motivates you to continue.
Oh yeah. I mean, when I had the first success, you know, people would say to me, well, how are you going to spend the money they're paying you? What do you get?
Right.
And I went, it's got nothing to do with that. It really, I went, that was great because I could feed the kids,
sure, yeah.
You know, and put a roof over our head that was better than the one we had. But it's the fact that doors open for you, and particularly when you have the early one where you have a sort of million plus seller, because it actually changes the way you're perceived, and so you can take an idea to a publisher and say, this is what I'm thinking about, and they say, great, let's do it.
Yeah.
I mean, that was back then. These days it's not quite as easy as that, because everything is tightened up and the money people have got so much more control.
Right.
But it was extraordinary, because the more those doors opened, the more it allowed me to come up with different ideas and pursue them.
Nick, what is your workspace like? I mean, do you work at home, say?
Yeah, I do. I had a studio, a sort of original size studio in Chinatown in Victoria for a few years. But I decided to close it down, and I work from home now in a very small space at the top of the house. But that's just because I've sort of physically retracted in terms of scale, because I was also, you know, painting at the same time as writing and producing images that went with the books.
Yeah.
I was also painting sort of 9x4 canvases as a way of keeping myself fresh and moving. But now I'm sort of focusing much more on sort of other things, like I'm also sort of working on a set of tarot cards, which is a tool of self.
So when I look at look through dubious documents and I see stamps and maps and the sort, do you collect those things? If, let's say, if you encounter something on your travels, do you take it home?
Yeah, I collect and collect and collect. I love paper ephemera,
yeah.
And the more you delve into it, the more it attaches you to a sense of historiosity. I mean, that does feel very important in this day and age, where it's where the slate often feels like it's wiped clean every 10 minutes, to actually have some things around you at least that make you feel like you're just sort of attached to the planet.
Yeah, and when I look through some of the pieces in Dubious Documents, you know, I know it's stuff that you've created, but I do feel a great sense of I'm holding something that that's been around longer than I have, and it has a history there that ought to be recognized, if you will.
Even if you don't understand exactly where it comes from, it's almost as if parental and grandparent memory seeps down through us in our DNA. Mm.
Yeah. The interaction with audiences over the years, I mean, did you enjoy that when someone tells you just how much, like we talked about Griffin and Sabrina?
Oh, yeah, of course. I love it. And, you know, when I first had to go out on stage, you know, I was petrified to death. But after about 6 months, I begin to actually enjoy that process of being around people and interacting with them. But, you know, obviously it's so much better when people are enthusiastic, and particularly when people ask, you know, good and challenging questions that make me think. I love it. I mean, that's what's being part of Alive is. I mean, whilst I said earlier I'm sort of quite reclusive, that's more of a balancing mechanism about making sure that I don't become overwhelmed by the constant output.
Yeah. You know, I'm sure a lot of people want a piece of you, right?
Early on, that was probably the weirdest thing of the lot, because to go from being, you know, the guy sitting on the bus with holes in his jeans to being the guy sitting on the bus still with holes in his jeans, but who had written a mysterious love story that was quite beloved. That was weird.
It's been such a pleasure to talk to you, such a pleasure to sit with Dubious Documents as I have over the last number of weeks.
And
share it with others. I so appreciate your time today. Congratulations on this book, and good luck with it.
And thanks a lot. Take care.
The book is called Dubious Documents, A Puzzle. It's published by Chronicle Books. Nick Bantock joined me on the line from Victoria, British Columbia, in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunto.